Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan. This episode, we're going to try something a little different. We're going to talk about a piece of pop music that's 100 years old, and we're going to do it with me flying solo, because I'm going to be talking about one of the most important artists in American music and one of my earliest musical memories. I'm talking about the composer George Gershwin. My grandma, Sally Sandfield, is an incredibly talented pianist, and at 94, she still plays every single day. When I was younger, I was constantly exposed to her playing some of the great classical composers, Chopin, Grieg, Bach, but the music that I always gravitated towards was whenever she would play the Gershwin piano preludes. These compositions really imprinted on my brain, and as I grew older, the music of George Gershwin really stayed with me. When I was playing jazz in high school, I would try and learn his brilliantly harmonically complex pop songs like Nice Work If You Can Get It, and But Not For Me, all with lyrics by his brother, Ira. And then later, I got to see his opera, Porgy and Bess, which features classic songs like Summertime, and was one of the first productions to feature an entirely African-American cast. But of all Gershwin's works, I think the one that has most embedded itself in culture is his piano concerto, Rhapsody in Blue, which premiered 100 years ago in February 1924. Gershwin was asked to write a jazz concerto that would be performed in New York City's Aeolian Hall. Although Gershwin initially declined, he eventually wrote a piece for two pianos in, get this, 3 weeks. He then passed the score to arranger Ferde Grofe, who orchestrated it for a full symphony. At the premiere, which was conducted by the bandleader Paul Whiteman, Gershwin himself played the piano. He called this piece a musical experiment. Part of what he was trying to do was mash up contemporary and classical music cultures, different musical traditions. You can hear that in just the opening notes of this piece. A famous clarinet glissando that rises up and up. And as you're listening to it, you're like, what am I hearing? This Jewish klezmer music, is it African-American blues? Is it a classical clarinet? It's all of the above at the same time. These characteristics reflect the life and experience of Gershwin himself. He was the son of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. He grew up in Manhattan and Brooklyn in the early 1900s, exposed to this melting pot of different cultures all meeting through the mass immigration to the shores of the United States and living shoulder to shoulder in these urban environments. He channeled all that into this piece. And ever since then, this piece has been inescapable in American culture and in world culture, really. Jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong would quote passages from Rhapsody in Blue in their solos. Ella Fitzgerald would give you a taste of its melodies when she was scat singing. Moving forward in time, United Airlines made Rhapsody and Blue the soundtrack of their airline.
Performing together with a single united purpose. That's what makes the world's leading airline flyer friendly.
But I think one of the most surprising reinventions of Rhapsody in Blue that I've encountered is its sampling in the 2022 track Birthday by the K-pop group Red Velvet. Despite the longevity of this piece, there's also some serious issues with it. For one thing, a lot of people think of this as a jazz symphony, but is it really jazz at all? There's no improvisation. There's no real jazz syncopation. And if it is jazz, because it does owe a lot to jazz rhythm and melody, then we have to acknowledge that this piece looks a lot like cultural appropriation, that in the eyes of many music historians, and even black artists from his time, Gershwin had co-opted this music that was coming out of Harlem. And Rhapsody in Blue was really his effort to make black music palatable for white audiences. So in the 100 years since its premiere, Rhapsody in Blue has become such a familiar piece of concert music. And on the centennial, I think we're going to be hearing it performed a lot. But will we actually reckon with some of the more complicated history of this piece? Well, there is one musician who is trying to do that, the pianist Laura Downs. On this 100th anniversary of Rhapsody in Blue, rather than just perform the piece, she commissioned Puerto Rican musician Edmar Colon to rearrange Gershwin's original score, adding Latin percussion and jazz improvisation to highlight the source material between Gershwin's grand musical experiment. The result is a piece called Rhapsody in Blue Reimagined, which Lara recently debuted in San Francisco. I sat down with her to learn why she felt it was time to revisit this American classic.
I'm Laura Downs, and I'm a pianist, recording artist, explorer of music. I don't know, how much do we hate the word storyteller, but I think I'm a storyteller of music.
We love the word storyteller.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I think it's not used enough. Okay. So let's go to the beginning of this project, Rhapsody Reimagined. Laura, what was the genesis of this idea?
Anniversaries, you know, they are complicated. And especially in my part of the music world, where I guess I still inhabit this place called classical music, and I have found that sometimes when we have these anniversaries, we don't do them very well, right? Like, let's play all Mozart all day for a year until everybody's just so tired. I think 100-year anniversaries are potentially problematic because 100 years is, I don't know, is it a long time or is it a short time? By some metrics, 100 years is a long time, and so now it's time to wrap the thing up and put it in the museum. Yeah.
Century, yeah.
I was just kind of cautious about it. I was getting a lot of calls to play the piece, and I was really starting to think, just for my own well-being, like, why do I care about this piece? What does this piece mean to me? I've always known that the most important thing to me about this piece, I mean, it's a great piece of music, but I think Gershwin's inspiration, Gershwin's vision for this piece is really, really special. You know, this phrase that he came up with when he called it the musical kaleidoscope of America, that's just always spoken to me so much. Mm-hmm. So I guess this whole thing started because I was thinking about, what does that mean? What is the musical kaleidoscope?
Yeah. As you say, this is such a canonic piece, such a celebrated piece, such a familiar piece. I totally understand and appreciate your instinct to want to come at it in a new way. Was there also a degree of nerves, maybe, to rethink such a iconic piece of American music?
Honestly, no. that stuff has surfaced since we started, because I didn't realize that a lot of people think about the 1924 version that was orchestrated by Ferdi Groffet as the original version by Gershwin. And I'd really never thought of that because I play very often the solo piano version, Gershwin's original. And so my relationship with the Groffet orchestration is just that. The starting point for me is the Gershwin piano score. And then look, well, this is really interesting and this is great what happened in 1924, because this other guy picked it up and arranged it for the band that they had on hand for this concert. I don't think of it as set in stone. So it's been surprising.
Fascinating. So to approach this piece and rearrange it, you don't even see yourself as the first person to do that. You're continuing a tradition of reworking and rearranging this piece.
Yeah, I mean, there are countless versions, right? I'm not even aware of all of them, I'm sure. But everybody from Ellington on down, like, people have played around with this piece. And I think it's telling that because this piece is claimed by the classical music world, we want to think of it as having one version because that's how we do things in the classical music world. Whereas everyone else is like, oh, what a great tune. What am I going to do with it this decade? And, you know, what's somebody else going to do with it? You know, songs evolve. Every time I'm working with somebody who comes at music from a different training, a different tradition, right? Yeah. They're like, you do what? You play the same notes the same way over and over and over again. Why would you do that?
So Gershwin, as you said, had
Ferdi Groffet
to arrange this piece. And you have a collaborator, Edmar Cologne. How did you know that Edmar was the person that you wanted to work with on this project?
So Edmar and I had met a year or so before this all started. We had met in Boston with the Boston Pops. We were doing a program with them of Ellington and Strayhorn. I had a new concerto that was done for me by the Pops and the Philadelphia Orchestra, which was based on three Strayhorn tunes. But the program opened with this arrangement that Edmar had done of Ellington's Caravan. And Edmar's Puerto Rican, and he had taken that song really back to its Puerto Rican roots, because it was co-written by Juan Tizol, and brought in this whole element of Afro-Caribbean percussion. And it was just this very dramatic statement about this is where this song comes from. And I knew that what I wanted to do with the Rhapsody was not just kind of imagine it into the present and the future, but also to investigate its roots, because I think there's so much in this score that is like Gershwin's 1924 attempt to translate something that is, you know, coming from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I knew that in order to funnel those two things together, I really wanted to work with Edmar. I mean, I literally was picking up the phone to call him as I was imagining this in my head. And it's been a really close and beautiful collaboration. And he knew as soon as I started to speak about this. I think there are lots of people I could have called who would have thought, oh, well, that's a cool and nifty idea, you know, to do something cool and nifty. But Edmar understood immediately that what I wanted to do was dig and then like rebuild. But always honoring this central vision of this melting pot thing.
How did that vision materialize musically? If someone was familiar with the original orchestration of Rhapsody in Blue, what might be some of the biggest changes that they would encounter in your and Edmar's Rhapsody Reimagined?
Well, I think probably the most obvious change is the element of percussion and what we're doing with rhythms. Because what he was able to do is to take these rhythms that, again, I think Gershwin was trying to translate from something, whether that was from Black music or from Latin influences. You know, he's kind of having to reduce them in a way, right? So if you let those reopen again and sort of imagine their source and the fullness of that source, I think that's the thing that most people will hear at first listen. There's also something about the tone, the color of the piece.
I feel like Rhapsody in Blue is kind of a unique piece because it has so many melodies and rhythms that remain so recognizable 100 years later. Were there any sections that you considered untouchable, I guess, that had to remain in your rearranged version?
Well, I mean, of course, the slow theme, right?
Yeah.
Because there would be a revolt. But you know that actually in the original, that section goes by really fast. Mm. I think we're waiting for it, always waiting for it. Then you're like, oh, there it is. And you don't realize that 3 minutes later, it's over. But if you know Gershwin's piano roll recording that he made himself in the 1920s, like he doesn't make a huge fuss about that section. Just goes. And we're used to 100 years of this, like, Hollywoodization, you know, of that theme. So it's a giant and it's all the strings and it's swoony. So I did have thoughts about just let's bring that into a more intimate place, which we have done in this version.
Yeah. The opening clarinet glissando is another moment in this piece that I think is instantly recognizable. And I kind of love the way Jørn Edmar's version handles that, because the way I heard it was almost like a bit of a tease, because you don't know if you're going to get it at first. And it's sort of almost like a game of cat and mouse with the listener. You hear this trill from the clarinet. It continues. You would think, are we going to get that explosive glissando up to that blue note? And then finally we hear it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm putting too much into this interpretation, but I did like that as a way of sort of dialoguing with the original and sort of playing with listeners' expectations a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. I think that was pretty much the idea. You know, the opening, there's more of an extended opening. The sound of that opening, you know, it's kind of rumbly and almost a little bit ominous because of this idea of Gershwin writing this piece in a time that was so politically charged and threatening in so many ways to exactly the existence of the America that he's celebrating in this piece. So we kind of wanted to lay that groundwork. And then that clarinet, yeah, it emerges from that and now takes us to this place that we know.
Can you say more about that? Is that because of the immigration restrictions that were instituted in 1924, which maybe curtailed this kaleidoscopic melting pot that Gershwin was trying to capture?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's that story about Gershwin finding out that he's supposed to write this piece because there's this article in the newspaper that says he's writing a piece for a concert that's coming up in 3 weeks. And he's, you know. But I really started to think about what else is in that newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, what's on the front page of that newspaper? Because it was just 3 months after the first performance of Rhapsody in Blue that that legislation, the Johnson Reed Act, was passed.
Wow.
Something here about the speed of American life and assimilation and how quickly things changed generation by generation. But Gershwin was 24 years old and he was a first generation American. And that legislation was directly targeting his parents, you know, his family, his community.
Yeah.
So I don't think that he ignored that. And living in our time when, you know, so much is so wrong, and I think that we as musicians, each in our own way, we're kind of trying to insist upon and celebrate and advocate for the America that we want to live in. I feel strongly that he must have been doing that. And so then that also takes Rhapsody in Blue away from this, like, harmless, familiar, hummable thing to maybe this is actually sort of a little act of rebellion.
Yeah.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Another radical moment to me in the Rhapsody Reimagined that has that spirit of rebellion is the inclusion of sections for improvisation by instrumentalists in the orchestra. Something that Gershwin's original didn't have, though it was inspired by jazz, it lacked what many perceive as a crucial element of jazz, which is spontaneous, extemporaneous improvisation. You've re-injected that into the piece. Why was that important to include?
Well, it was an experiment, right? The piece was written for this concert that was called An Experiment in Modern Music. And this whole idea was so new because everything about it was new. Jazz was new. And so the idea that this composer who, I mean, he wasn't one thing or another thing. He was somebody whose roots came from the Yiddish theater and vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley. And yes, also orchestral writing. But for him to, I was going to say absorb, but it wasn't a question of absorb. It was really a question of like, blend these two big things, this European classical tradition and this Black American tradition, which again is in its infancy. And the primary element of that is improvisation. And it probably couldn't have been done because of the constraints of the setting, you know, and the respectability part, which was to bring this piece into this concert hall with ladies in fur coats, you know,
right.
But because that is the origin story of the piece, it felt necessary to acknowledge it and
yeah,
make space for it.
Right. I think Paul Whiteman would say that he was trying to make a lady out of jazz was his line.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of gendered and class kind of assumptions in that desire. And it's powerful to the idea of like returning this concert work to its roots in improvised music and the kind of settings of nightclubs and saloons where you would have heard that.
Yeah.
There's also an element in this piece that is very unique to me and similarly kind of infuses your arrangement with a relevance and an urgency. It's what you call the site-specific element of this piece. Tell us more about that.
I mean, America is a really big place. And I think a big part of the equation of American music is that it can't just be one thing. So the idea here is that as this piece travels to different communities, different regions, we also want to make space and place for those local histories. So the first performance was in San Francisco, and obviously a hugely essential part of the history of the West Coast and California is the story of Chinese immigration. So we had an ensemble of traditional Chinese instruments, but as the piece moves around the country, you know, maybe that section gets given to a bluegrass ensemble or, you know, a blues combo or whatever, just to really link this idea of the musical kaleidoscope also to specific little, what do you call the things that are in the kaleidoscope? I don't know. The little shapes in the kaleidoscope.
You've stumped me, Lara. I have a PhD, but I'm utterly bewildered by that question. We'll have to. So a listener will
find out.
The context of this piece being written in 1924 in this landscape of changing policy and a sort of battle over American identity, this is not just kind of an abstract history for you. You also have a personal connection to this moment and to this anniversary.
Yeah. I don't have a PhD, but I've learned so much through the process of examining this piece. So again, back to the Johnson Reed Act, no more immigration from Asia. That got completely shut down. Nobody from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, the common denominator here being anybody who wasn't pretty white, right? So Northern, Western Europe. And especially if you were from Great Britain, please come in because clearly you are white. And they just sort of forgot about the British West Indies, right?
Huh.
So I had always known that in the 20s and 30s, there was this huge wave of immigration from places like Jamaica, where my family's from, but I didn't know the why of that. And this is the why of that, because you could have a visa as a British citizen and come from the islands. And so in the process of digging into that, I found that my grandfather had come to Harlem from Jamaica in 1924. I joke about that, and I really do think it was just kind of a loophole and an oversight. But there's so much about that time that just is feeling to me so connected to our time, right? All the good things that are happening I mean, there's a lot of good that's happening in our culture. When you talk about American identity, we have this whole reinvestigation of identity, and we are making huge changes culturally in our society. And at the same time, this giant, ugly pushback against it.
Yeah. There's so many pieces of classical music that, whether Rhapsody in Blue is a piece of classical music or not, is I shouldn't just say that, but certainly it's a piece of concert music. And often these works, I think, sort of exist maybe as memes or as little snippets that you find in Saturday morning cartoons. Rhapsody in Blue has a remarkable longevity. It's something that you hear sampled in a K-pop song in 2022. It's something you hear quoted by jazz musicians in their solos. It's the musical tag for United Airlines, and the actor Sean Hayes performed it nightly on Broadway in a celebrated turn as where he was playing the pianist Oscar Levant. And I saw many sort of viral videos of him playing a wonderful rendition of Rhapsody in Blue. I'm curious if you have any insight into why this particular piece might have this lasting power and be something that people continually come back to and try and engage with.
I guess this is where I do tap into my relationship with classical music, because you can ask that question about every piece of music that has lasted centuries. And I think it comes down to, yes, the hummable tunes. I was just at a concert of Beethoven's Ninth, and there was a guy behind me in the audience who was waiting for the hummable tunes. Like, there are these pieces that hold those snippets, and you have such a close relationship with those snippets that the whole piece is your waiting room for the snippets. I'm not saying that that's true of Beethoven's Ninth, but nobody can hum the entirety of Beethoven's Ninth. Right. So I think there's that. But I also, in my quest to kind of demystify classical music, I'm always talking about the humanity that's in these pieces of music, because I do think that that's why we care. I think that's why we do still care about Beethoven. I think that we are, whether we know it or not, we're having a relationship with his struggle and his rage and his living in a time of revolution and war and all those things. It just comes through. And I think the same is true of Chopin. And I think the same is true of this piece. And I couldn't have told you why, maybe, until, you know, I learned more about this moment. And again, like, you don't need to know the details, but I think it's just something visceral that comes through. And for this piece, for Gershwin, I think also there's just this really obvious energy that is a result of living in this time when everything's moving so fast, and this excitement of discovering new things and trying to, like, embrace all of them. I think that's what it is, because plenty of music from the 1920s that does not have the same magic.
Yeah. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This has been fun. And you didn't ask me any scary musicology questions.
No, I can. I'm happy to. No, we have a few more minutes. I could just get one in there.
Switched on Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz. This episode was engineered by Bill Lance and edited by Art Chung. Abby Barr does our community management, and Iris Gottlieb makes our illustrations. Nishat Kurwa is our executive producer. We're a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network and a production of Vulture. You can find more episodes of our show anywhere you get podcasts. Go to our website, switchedonpop.com. Talk to us on social media. What's your favorite George Gershwin sample flip, for instance? We want to hear it. And sign up for our newsletter. We'll be blasting you on a semi-weekly basis with pertinent facts and great stories and our favorite playlists. So sign up for that in our show notes or on the website. Okay, lastly, exciting episode alert. We're going to be diving into the music of the premier hip-hop festival, Rolling Loud. Our very own Rihanna Cruz was there, IRL, soaking up the sights, the sounds, the sweat. And Rihanna's going to report back on what we need to know about the state of hip-hop in 2024 based on what they saw there. All that remains for me to say is thank you for listening.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.